Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the the education channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Tom DeSena, from the Department of Communication, Journalism, and Public Relations at Oakland University. My guest today is Neil Vallely, the author of Futilitarianism, Neoliberalism, and the Production of Uselessness. In Futilitarianism, Vallely eloquently tells the story of how neoliberalism transform the relationship between utility maximization and the common good. Drawing on a vast array of contemporary examples from self-help literature and marketing jargon to political speeches and governmental responses to the COVID-19 pandemic, the book demonstrates that in the neoliberal decades, the practice of utility maximization traps us in useless and repetitive behaviors that foreclose the possibility of collective happiness. The book argues that at a time of epic-defining disasters, from climate emergencies to deadly pandemics, countering the futility of neoliberal existence is essential to building an egalitarian, sustainable, and hopeful future. Neil Vallely is a political and social theorist based at the University of Otago, New Zealand. His research has appeared in journals such as Rethinking Marxism, Angelici, and Poetics Today, and magazines including The New Internationalist and Roar. In 2022, he will take up a two-year Rutherford Foundation postdoctoral fellowship at Otago, working on the history of capitalism and migrant detention. An Italian translation of Futilitarianism will be published in March 2022. Neil, welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for inviting me on.
I'd like to start our discussion today by asking you what brought you to this project, and especially this rather unique coinage. That is, why Futilitarianism and why now?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. So the genesis of the book really began in 2015, 2016. I just finished my PhD at Otago. You might be able to tell from my accent that I'm originally from Ireland. And then Otago went through a big wave of humanities cuts in 2016. And so I started thinking at this time around the idea of uselessness around around the humanities. And not in the sense that other people thought about, which is, you know, defending the uselessness of the humanities, which, you know, is a worthwhile endeavor in itself, but rather thinking about how the humanities have come to be conceived as useless. And this then kind of, the project sort of expanded from there. I started to see that this idea of uselessness, or what eventually I came to define as futility, actually permeates so much of everyday life in the 21st century, and has become even a lived experience for many people. And so it's become a kind of subjective phenomenon as well. And then this took me into thinking about the relationship between utility and futility, which led me back into the history of utilitarianism, which we might talk a little bit about, and how that came. I started to see how the history of utilitarianism started to influence the rise of neoliberalism. but also how forms of say utility maximization have become central to actually existing neoliberalism. And this is where it evolves into what I call futilitarianism, you know, the where we are forced to kind of maximize utility on an individual level, but in doing so, it actually leads to the worsening of our kind of collective and social and economic conditions. And I guess we'll get into that in more detail, but that was kind of genesis of the idea and of the project.
So you start your book by drawing what I think is a really important distinction between futility and nihilism. Can you talk a little bit about how you understand the differences between those two terms, and also the different variations on nihilism that you identify in our contemporary culture?
Yeah, thank you. Well, it's really interesting because people have really picked up on that distinction that I draw in the introduction, and it's only a short section of the introduction, but I think it is an important distinction that needs to be made. For me, I see the distinction between futility and nihilism in quite simple terms, in that nihilism is a kind of end in itself. So it requires a taking up of a certain position. And so in that, I use the philosopher Simon Critchley's distinction between what he calls passive nihilism and active nihilism. And passive nihilism for him is forms of meaninglessness that manifest in a kind of stepping back from the world. So it could be represented in kind of people just kind of accept that there's a kind of, the world is meaningless and kind of just get on with things. And active nihilism, which is about trying to destroy the world as it exists to bring in the kind of new one. And he sees that in the form of kind of terrorism or things like that. But both are driven kind of by a kind of overall meaninglessness. Whereas futility for me is a more kind of unconscious and insidious process, where even lots of people might feel that they are actually contributing to the world in meaningful ways. So that futility actually exists kind of more in a background, and you have to kind of strip it away to see it. Whereas nihilism, I think, can be quite obvious in many scenarios. So I see futility as the starting point of something beyond nihilism. So part of the desire to write the book and the desire that the impetus behind the idea of the theory of futilitarianism is to try and avoid descending into nihilism, trying to show the futility of kind of everyday life in the 21st century as a means to try and construct something that can actually move beyond that futility, can actually counter that futility, to build something that doesn't end up in nihilism. And that's the kind of the main impetus that I draw out in that distinction in the introduction.
Yeah, as you say, it's a relatively short discussion in the book, but I think a lot hinges on that distinction, which is why I wanted to bring it up. So let's then talk a little bit about utility. What's the basic idea here? I suspect lots of people in our audience will know, but let's run through it anyway, and then talk about how the idea started to insinuate itself into not just our collective consciousness here, but also in terms of our practices in everyday life.
Yeah, I think that's really that's obviously kind of central to the book, and I think so. The concept of utility, I draw back into the kind of intellectual history of that term, particularly back to Bentham's utilitarianism, which is the idea of Jeremy Bentham, the kind of late 18th. Early 19th century social reformer and philosopher, English social reformer and philosopher, and what he calls the principle of utility, which is essentially the property of an object that produces pleasure over pain, and eventually this idea grew into interventions by later utilitarian thinkers like John Stuart Mill it grew into the concept of the greatest happiness principle, which I'm sure many people might be aware of, which is effectively that the most moral course of action is the one that generates the most happiness for the greatest number of people. It's the kind of simple definition of kind of utilitarianism and of the greatest happiness principle. But it's also important that utilitarianism is a kind of a consequentialist ethics. So it's morality is judged by the consequences of an action and not by kind of pre-reflection that occurs before an action takes place. But it's also an aggregate of ethics, which is really important in the context of capitalism, and I might touch on that in a minute or two. Because the measurement of utility or of happiness or of pleasure, whatever you call it, takes place at an individual level initially and then is aggregated to the level of the collective. So we see this even play out in our kind of societies now with the logic of kind of statistics or surveys, where the social whole is constructed entirely through individual inputs. That's very much at the base of Benthamite utilitarianism. And then Bentham's ideas of utility and subsequent utilitarian thoughts of utility had a really strong influence on the rise of economic science in the 19th century, especially classical, neoclassical economists, from economists say as David Ricardo and William Stanley Jevons. In fact, actually, the editor of Bentham's collective works, Werner Stark, he draws a direct parallel between Bentham and Ricardo. He calls them flesh of one flesh, blood of one blood, because they share the belief that man is essentially a selfish animal and that it is useless to fight that selfishness. So then I chart in that opening chapter of the book, I chart the grounding of this principle of utility and the influence of utilitarianism on economic science into the 20th century, and then the emergence of a kind of an anti-utilitarian thinking in the wildly contrasting ideas of John Maynard Keynes and Friedrich Hayek. They're both vehemently critical of Bentham's ideas, but from completely different directions. So Keynes, in many ways, tries to retain that kind of collective intention of utilitarianism, whereas Hayek has the emphasis on the idea of society as a collection of individual interests. So part of the aim in the book is that, you know, there is a kind of strong discipline now of the intellectual history of neoliberalism. And the kind of opening chapter of the book here is to chart a kind of alternative, not a different, because I think the intellectual histories that exist are extremely important, but the relationship between utilitarianism and neoliberalism hasn't really been charted. And that was the kind of the impetus for the main part of the book. And it's from there that the examination of utilitarianism kind of emerges from the kind of historical foundations built in that opening chapter of the book.
So you go on in the next chapter to describe this creature called Homo Futilitas. So let's talk a little bit about this person, and I think especially the community that such a person lives in or creates essentially for themselves.
Yeah. Again, this is another thing that people have kind of picked up on that term. It's funny, when you write a book, you're never quite sure what's
going to resonate.
Yeah, exactly, resonate, and it's often things that kind of surprise you. So this creature, this figure, Homo Futilitas, is in many ways a kind of playful conception, and what I kind of describe it, a kind of evolution of the more established kind of Homo economicus. Mm-hmm. But it goes back to human capital theory, essentially, and this chapter is mainly a critique of human capital theory and the kinds of subjectification that take place as a result of human capital theory. So human capital theory, in a very short description, emerged as a extremely important part of kind of neoliberal economic thinking, particularly in the work of someone like Gary Becker from the Chicago School of Economics. And in a very brief, basic way, it's essentially seeing the human being, seeing ourselves as a form of capital, so that everything we do is a kind of investment in our human capital. And this logic is often used, you know, to in the kind of, I guess, in universities, in the kind of realm that we work in, to justify the fact that students should have to pay for their education, because they're making an investment in their future human capital. And it's basically their responsibility whether it's a good investment or a bad investment. And therefore, education transforms from something like a social right, as something that citizens should get as citizens, to something that people invest in themselves, and they must make the right investment. And then, of course, this again, which I touch on later in the book, but feeds into the decline of the humanities and things like that. But I can talk about that a bit later if we want to. Sure. And Foucault, Michel Foucault, kind of. He identified this kind of development within neoliberal thought, and he came up with the kind of famous kind of catchphrase of we become entrepreneurs of the self, in the neoliberal period. So life therefore becomes this almost kind of permanent commercial project. So in that chapter, I spent a bit of time doing a kind of close reading of quite a well-known essay called "The Brand Called You" by a business writer called Tom Peters. It's kind of late 90s. Yep. And in that book, he talks basically in completely unironic ways about how we
just kind of an amazing thing to pull off if you think about it.
It is quite incredible, and I think that's the scary thing about it. It's not that an essay like this exists, because you can imagine that exists.
Sure.
But that the person writing it is so sincere about it. I think this is kind of
this is terrific.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and he very unashamedly talks about that we must become kind of head marketers of Me Inc. and everything we do must be thinking about how we look to other people. And I draw a little bit there on the kind of German media theorist Bingjul Han, who has this idea that we are no longer subjects, we have become projects, and that we're always reinventing ourselves, seeing ourselves as something that needs to be worked on. And actually, this logic of self-branding really encapsulates, I think, that process. And another quote that I used in that chapter, which I found deeply terrifying, which again, the person saying it found it, kind of said it very sincerely, was from Jeff Bezos, who said, your self-brand is what people say about you when you're not in the room. And this, to me, is... And this leads into what you're talking about, the idea of community, that like this is such a succinct definition of paranoia.
Yeah.
And it can only lead, if we're constantly thinking about what people are saying about us when we're not in the room, it can only lead to what I call, therefore, a paranoid community. So a community of people who are brands, of self-brands, is always characterized by need and distrust. These are the two kind of things I identify. So one is the need for others to buy into one's brand, but also the distrust that others will or will continue to buy into that brand. Because you can never know what people are saying about you when you're not in the room.
Absolutely.
So it creates this constant need to be reinventing yourself, to selling yourself, essentially. And Wendy Brown, the kind of famous theorist of neoliberalism, she makes that point that under this kind of neoliberal rationality, selling one's soul has become kind of quotidian. It's just, you know, as it's
what you do.
Yeah, it's the only thing you can do. But it's just, and it's so it leads to this very perverted sense of community, which I think you touched on in the question. A community that is defined by competition and paranoia, and I draw a little bit here on Marx, which he talks about the kind of illusory community of capitalism, where freedom only really exists for the ruling classes. And for Marx, real freedom, a real community, is where individuals obtain their freedom through their associations with others. But this is really at odds with kind of neoliberal rationality, where freedom is always understood as freedom from others. So what I'm kind of trying to do in that chapter is to lay out the kind of impact that such a conception of society has on our individual subjectivities, but also the way that we interact with other people. And this leads to the rise, therefore, of what I call the kind of homo futilitas, this being who's constantly trying to sell itself to other people and constantly trying to define itself as different from other people, but in doing so finds itself trapped in this kind of futile endeavor of trying to be seen, of trying to sell oneself, and ending up in further debt, ending up doing jobs that they don't want to be doing, ended up doing jobs that are, you know, as David Graeber called bullshit jobs that have mm-hmm. no social utility and things like that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've done some work on the idea of employability, and there's a lot of parallel there. And it's not just a matter of creating this, as you said, I mean, it's a perfect phrasing of the community of competition and paranoia, but it's also just the sort of sheer exhaustion of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That if you're constantly worried about what other people are saying behind your back, and as you quote, that you're no longer a subject, but a project. It's just, you know, at some point the system breaks down just out of sheer overuse.
Yeah, exactly. And the kind of psychological impact of behaving like that, of constantly, part of the reason that enables us to be human is to be able to set aside the fact that people are talking about us, that people have ideas of us that we don't know. And if we keep that front and center, if we're constantly thinking about what people are thinking about us, it was completely crippling. Kind of, it's a thing that we don't want to know, what we shouldn't know, because it would stop us from actually living.
But then it seems there's almost an entire industry built around trying to determine what people, you know, the online reputation managers and things along those lines, that, you know, and you have some interesting things in, I think, the next chapter about the university, but, you know, what are students saying about you in online fora and, you know, things along those lines.
Yeah, and that's interesting. Here in New Zealand, we don't have some of those, you know, like Rate My Professor or
yeah.
kind of public evaluations of teaching or of other things. As we have, you know, student evaluations and things like that, but they're kind of internal to the university. But yeah, even that, the way that kind of manifests in the way that you might go into a classroom and teach students, you're constantly thinking about how you'll be seen in the kind of public sphere, and what it's not even just how you'll be seen, but what that says about you as a person.
Right.
Yeah, and part of the impetus for this, the book is that to show that this sense of futility that I kind of name as futility, this experience that we have, that we all experience in slightly different ways, is actually not a defect of our individual characters, even though we all seem to feel like it is, or encouraged to feel like it, that it's a defect of our individual characters. It's actually integral to kind of the system in which we live in, particularly with its kind of neoliberal mutation and the kind of subjective normalities that it engenders.
So one of the terms that draws your attention is the idea of responsibility. Mm. And so let's talk a little bit about what makes this, you know, seemingly positive attribute a particularly troublesome one in a futilitarian age. And here I'm especially interested in your reflections on the university as a system.
Yeah, well, thanks, Tom. So the logic of particularly personal responsibility is so central to neoliberalism. Many other scholars have noted this point. You know, Wendy Brown talks about the process of responsabilization, the passing of systemic problems onto the individual. Others have talked about, you know, that neoliberalism is a kind of personal responsibility crusade. But what I kind of look at here is how the logic and the rationality of personal responsibility cements the futilitarian condition, the condition that I identify in chapters 1 and 2, because everything is then seen as a reflection of our individual characters and our abilities or inabilities to cope. And so I look in this chapter at the kind of political construction of personal responsibility, which immediately or initially occurred under with the new rights and the rise of you know of Reagan in the US, Thatcher in the UK, and in other places as well. But Reagan in his inaugural speech, I think it's inaugural speech. Yeah, and he makes the point where he says, you know, if no one among us is capable of governing himself, then who among us has the capacity to govern someone else? And what you see here is this kind of centering of the individual as the primary source of responsibility. And you basically, you must look after your own house if you're going to do anything about someone else's house. And I mean, that obviously builds into a kind of project of seeing the government as kind of antithetical to individual freedom and so on and so forth. That was really central to Reagan's politics. And then similar with Thatcher in the UK, you know, the very famous phrase that she came up with, there's no such thing as society, right, only individuals and their families. So this kind of dismantling of the idea of society, and that we're all just kind of individuals, we must look after our own ourselves and our families before we kind of think about any kind of social solidarity, anything like that. And I mean, that's been well documented and quite logical, I think, to the New Right project. But what I spend a lot of time in this chapter is actually looking at the left-wing origins of personal responsibility, and particularly with the rise of the kind of third way left under Clinton and Blair, and then into Obama as well. And personal responsibility is really central to Clinton's politics, particularly the dismantling of the welfare state that occurs under Clinton, especially the act that actually has is named Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act. And in here, and with his rhetoric around this dismantling of the welfare state, he constructs this idea of dependency as a kind of mortifying condition. To be dependent on the state is to lead a kind of less dignified life than others. So it's a kind of a shaming of the idea of dependency. And a sense that you are not as much, you're not as strong or resilient individual as other people. Blair builds on the kind of Clinton reimagining of responsibility, with blending kind of Thatcherism and the third way left. Some scholars have called this Blatcherism, which I always find quite a funny neologism. But he links personal responsibility very much with this idea of opportunity. So he it's almost like a kind of carrot and stick or a contract with the public. He says basically those who take on greater personal responsibility will get more opportunities. So it's a relationship between taking responsibility for your own situation will get you more opportunities. Whether that actually is the case is very debatable. But that's the logic behind Blair's thinking. And then Obama brings in a kind of new version of responsibility in response, personal responsibility in response to the global financial crisis. So in his inaugural address in 2009, he calls for what he calls a new era of responsibility for American citizens. But this is for, you know, each individual American citizen must take greater responsibility for themselves. But at the same time, it's kind of absolving responsibility for those who actually caused the crisis, which is, you know, the financial sector and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I call this in this chapter, you know, the futilitarian spirit of capitalism. So where previous spirits of capitalism, you know, from Max Weber's work or even Luc Boltanski, Eve Ciapello, their book New Spirit of Capitalism, those spirits of capitalism at least promise some sort of reward for the hard work of capital accumulation. Whereas in Obama's speech, the kind of what's really lacking is a kind of sense that this American citizens will get anything for taking greater responsibility. In fact, he says that this new era of responsibility is merely the price of citizenship. So it's a kind of new turn, which I think overlaps with kind of post 2008 neoliberalism that you know, some scholars have defined as punitive neoliberalism. Pierre Dardot, Christian Laval, the French kind of thinkers call that post 2008 neoliberalism a war on the population, and you start to see the kind of the seeds of that in Obama's speech. So overall here, what I'm kind of situating the idea of personal responsibility is in within the wider project of progressive neoliberalism, what Nancy Fraser calls progressive neoliberalism, which is the kind of blending of neoliberal economics with a progressive politics of recognition. So she argues, you know, that Clinton talked the talk of diversity while walking the walk of Goldman Sachs. Yeah, and it's a very nice kind of turn of phrase, but I think really taps into how the left actually complete the project that's begun by Reagan and Thatcher. And kind of blasé terms, the left kind of make neoliberalism cool.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
So this chapter contains, and I don't know if you have a copy of the book in front of you, but on page 93, there's just what I regard as just an absolutely terrific kind of distillation here of some of the things you're talking about. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind reading this paragraph.
Yeah, so which is it? One, my ultimate point here?
My ultimate point.
Yeah, I can read that. Yeah. So my ultimate point here is that the denigration of the notion of dependency in favor of personal responsibility undermines an ontological necessity. We are and always will be dependent on others for our existential safety. No amount of personal responsibility can escape this fact. Without any safeguards outside our individual selves, we cannot trust the external world will hold up its end of the bargain. There are endless events that can put us at risk: economic downturn, redundancy, pandemics. And the inability to guarantee our security outside of ourselves can only breed a culture of fear. We cannot know the inner workings of the market, the minds of our employers, or even our bodies, but we can hazard a guess, which can lead to crippling paranoia and hypochondria. This is the real opportunity of responsibility that new right and third way politicians are so fond of encouraging, the opportunity to feel profoundly precarious in our own responsibility.
So I have to tell you, Neil, I read a lot of this kind of material in my work, and I don't know that I have ever read a more brilliant distillation of our contemporary condition than this paragraph.
Oh, that's very, very kind. Thank you.
It just touches on so many things and is so eloquently expressed that, it's worth the price of the book.
Thank you.
If only for that. Kind. Let's talk a little bit about semio futility. So what do we mean by this term and how do you find it mobilized, in our culture today?
Yeah. So this term kind of surprised me. I don't really know where it came from. And it was, really one of the first things I wrote that came part of the book. So the process, this chapter looks at these two simultaneous and interlinked processes that I define as semi-futility and symbolic indigestion. And they are an effect of the rise of kind of digital communication and what I call the kind of hyper-production of language in digital communication. Others have called this, you know, Franco Bifo Berardi talks about the idea of semio-inflation, which essentially that so much language is circulating in the same way that under normal forms of inflation, too much money or whatever is circulating, and it leads to the devaluation of meaning, essentially. There's too many words circulating, therefore their meaning kind of has less value. And semi-futility kind of builds on this idea. So semi-futility is essentially is the inability of language to create an affect, to have meaning. So I use the example of the overuse of the term crisis, for instance, in contemporary kind of media in particular. And so when everything becomes described as crisis, then crisis becomes the norm. And then it makes it extremely difficult to use the word crisis to elevate something beyond the norm. So the term crisis, the use of the term crisis stops to have meaning, and this ceases to have meaning. And that's what I mean by semi-futility. So another good example is the use of the term climate emergency. So I live in Dunedin in New Zealand, in Otago, and the city council here declared Dunedin a climate emergency a couple of years ago. And there's a kind of sense, but that hasn't, no one's really behaving as if it's an emergency. And it's this word emergency, which has supposed to have this kind of affect, supposed to provoke us in a certain way, to make us do something, has actually lost that kind of affect. It's just a word amongst other words. And this is what I mean by, this is an effect of semi-futility, of the overproduction of language. Meaning becomes increasingly detached from its use, meaning becomes kind of flattened out. Words cease to have this effective capacity. And this also bleeds into then the other process that I call symbolic indigestion, because meaning requires digestion, and digestion requires time. You know, in the body, it's a kind of catabolic process, you know, breaking down these larger chunks of food in the body, but in communication language, into kind of smaller digestible molecules. Sorry. But when language circulates constantly, and we're at the same time, you know, producer and consumer of language, there's no space or time to digest. So it's just this kind of constant noise. This is a phenomenon that Jody Dean calls, you know, talk without response. You know, everyone is talking, but no one is listening. And so this lack of listening, this inability to digest meaning or digest language and turn it into meaning, both feeds the process of semi-futility, but also it undermines our capacity to build kind of common bonds, because listening is really central to building kind of commonalities between us. But if no one is listening and everyone is just producing, it feeds and cements the kind of individualizing process that occurs under neoliberalism.
There's a quote that I'm fond of reciting for my students from Mark Twain, who says that the difference between the right word and the almost right word is like the difference between lightning and the lightning bug. And reading this chapter, though, it made me think that perhaps in an era of semi-futility, there's no more lightning.
That's a really nice way of putting it, yeah.
So you start the chapter on the politics of futility with an anecdote from a 2017 speech of Obama, where he provides us with the admonition that we get the politicians we deserve. Yeah, that was really irritating. So what does this almost tautological phrase tell us so much about politics in the utilitarian era?
Yeah, it annoyed me as well when I saw that, because it really absolving any kind of responsibility and maybe even...
And misunderstanding misunderstanding the election.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, at a fundamental level, you still come back to the fact that, you know, in a functioning democracy, Hillary Clinton would have been the president because
she got more votes. Yeah.
Millions, but it wasn't even close.
So, exactly. Anyway. It was missed the point on so many levels, but I think it was part of a project of deflecting a kind of responsibility on the part of himself or of the Democratic Party. But you're right, on a very fundamental level, it really does not understand exactly how democracy works. But more importantly, I think it's part of a wider process of depoliticization that occurs under neoliberalism. And he seems to I think in this statement suggest that there's a kind of lack of political desire or political will amongst the kind of populace in the US at this time. And I make the point here that actually not that I, in any way, I'm suggesting that you shouldn't vote, but to see not voting in that election as a lack of political desire actually misses the point that some people might have voted, that not voting was actually an expression of political desire to not have the choice between these two figures.
Yeah.
But also, I think more importantly in this chapter, I think the more pertinent question we could ask there is, you know, rather than we get the politicians we deserve, is why have we come to deserve this? And so this chapter, instead of looking at politics on a kind of macro level, which, you know, most political theorists will do, I delve into kind of micro political actions as a way to think about politics on a bigger level through these kind of micro actions. And so I look at that, particularly at actions that seem to be challenging the status quo, but actually reinforce these kind of neoliberal forms of depoliticization. And the three key micro political actions I look at are boycotting, this idea of voting with your dollar, and antinatalism. Boycotting is a kind of form of consumer activism, and it obviously evolves from the idea of boycotting, but where boycotting entailed, you know, deliberately not buying a product or not watching a certain TV show or so on and so forth.
Inflicting a punishment on someone who's...
Exactly, yeah. Boycotting is that you deliberately buy a product that is in opposition to the other product. And what it allows us to do is to both have the political but also consume at the same time. And I find
it encourages a kind of virtue signaling on the part of capitalist enterprises.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. You can see how certain capitalist enterprises and products then kind of manipulate the way consumers in a way to make the consumer feel like they are being political, while at the same time they are merely just kind of consuming. The vote with your dollar phrase I deliberately use because for a couple of reasons, and I'll explain that second. It's used by this organization called Green America, which is quite a big environmental political kind of organization, and they have this toolkit. Essentially, it's called Vote With Your Dollar Toolkit, and the premise of it is that the decisions we make with our money, with our credit cards, reflect our value system. But really interestingly, they set this idea of voting with your dollar up against the idea of governmental politics. So they see governmental politics as getting in the way of our value system. And they see, and very much they refer to Washington with this kind of very deep suspicion. And what I show here is that this vote with your dollar, this suspicion of governmental politics, overlaps very much with many of the neoliberal thinkers and the way that they thought about governmental politics. And actually Ludwig von Mises, an Austrian neoliberal thinker, who's quite a big following, and still does with many kind of neoliberals in the US, he actually had a very similar idea to voting with your dollar, where he said that the average man is both better informed and less corruptible in the decisions he makes as a consumer than as a voter at political elections. And this is the kind of this Green America, which we would, it's an environmental political organization, and yet it seems to be advocating positions that are extremely that overlap intimately with a kind of neoliberal view of politics. This idea that we essentially, by voting with our dollar, we are making a difference to the world, and we can sidestep this governmental politics that seems to get in the way of our freedom. And then the final one is the anti-natalism, which is a kind of growing, again, environmental politics around, you know, that people should stop having children. That's the best way to prevent climate change. And then here you see that kind of, an example of, you know, Mark Fisher's point of capitalist realism, where capitalism occupies a whole realm of the imaginable. And so it becomes easier to basically end the human race than to end capitalism. But also necessarily doesn't reflect the kind of uneven distribution of the way that we pollute the world, that it's actually the kind of big countries in the global north that are causing the most. It's the carbon dependence of these societies that are causing the kind of problem towards the problem of climate change. But again, we reflect the responsibility for the climate crisis back on the individual. So it's your choice. If you choose to have children, you're contributing to climate change, and so on and so forth. So again, it reflects, again, the process of responsabilization that occurs under neoliberalism that I charted in chapter 3 of the book. And you even see it into some movements like Extinction Rebellion. There was an example of someone carrying a sign at an Extinction Rebellion protest in London that said socialism or extinction. And this moved, you know, the UK XR movement to come out and say, you know, we don't support this sign, we are not a political movement, and so on and so forth. So this idea that we can't, that it's actually taking environmental politics away from a wider political project. And it corresponds, it's not antithetical to neoliberalism, it actually corresponds with neoliberal forms of depoliticization. And I think this is what I call, therefore, the kind of politics of futility.
So your book came out kind of in the middle of this pandemic that has continued to upend the lives of millions. Just for context, my home state is looking at hospitalization rates that actually exceed where they were at the beginning of the pandemic. So how do you see the relationship between the futilitarian condition and our attempts to grapple with this?
Yeah, and I think I probably speak from a kind of, well, I speak from a very privileged position in global terms, but also from being in New Zealand, where we've really avoided to this point, we've avoided the real devastating impact of COVID-19. And we are now, you know, Omicron has, in the last couple of days, just made it into the community. And we are, as even politicians and experts have kind of said, we are very unprepared for an Omicron outbreak. So we may well experience the same kind of things that you're experiencing as well in your home state. And this chapter also poses, on a kind of writing level, the difficulty of writing about something that's happening at that moment, because by the time the book comes out, the chapter is already dated, and especially with the pandemic, the way that things have changed so drastically throughout, and the variants and so on and so forth. So what I try to do in this chapter is more, rather than kind of make a comment on the pandemic, it is to try and locate some of the thinking, particularly around the pandemic response, within this wider theory of futilitarianism. And initially to do that is to show how utilitarian thinking has been really central to many of the COVID responses, probably less so in New Zealand, which is perhaps why our response has been successful. There's other reasons for that also, but in other countries, particularly in the US, in the UK, parts of Europe, Australia, there was very initially from the get-go, there kind of cost-benefit analysis, essentially, about how many deaths are acceptable to protect the economy. And I actually use the example of the Vice-Chancellor of Melbourne University writing a piece in Australian newspaper, where he literally, he doesn't even disguise the kind of discussion. He basically makes the question, you know, how valuable is a 90-year-old life compared to a 23-year-old life? And, you know, that this 23-year-old can contribute to the economy, can contribute to building economy in the aftermath of the pandemic. The 90-year-old is only a drain in this economy. Therefore, we need to weigh up, like, whether we just let this thing go. Basically, a kind of cull of older people. And writing this in a kind of one of the kind of major newspapers in Australia is kind of sense of how central this, or how utilitarians have become really front and center to many of the responses to the pandemic. I also look at the first CARES Act that was brought in the US under Trump, which Robert Bremner, the kind of Marxist historian, called a billionaire coronavirus bonanza. and the way that, and we see stories every single day of how the kind of billionaires and owners of, you know, big companies like Amazon or so on have made a lot of money during the pandemic. But I would now slightly hazard that analysis of CARES Act with the second CARES Act was brought in under Biden, which again, I mean, there's certain problems with it, but certainly seems a bit more a more responsible form of kind of intervention in the economy that actually does on some level kind of protect people more than so than the first one that came out. And I also use another example from Australia, which is the pandemic pushed the government, or allowed the government, to bring in a reform to the university system in Australia, and particularly bring in what they call the Jobs Ready Graduate Program. And this basically entailed raising the cost of humanities courses. So now in Australia, humanities papers or courses will cost, you know, up to three times as much as, say, a business degree or
engineering.
Engineering and things like that, essentially, so that you trying again, and that as part of a kind of wider political project to dismantle the humanities. You know, as Will Davies has called in the UK, he's stressing that the humanities have become the enemy within. And so again, so what I'm trying to look at here is that how some of these responses to the pandemic actually are furthering a kind of political project that was already existing before the pandemic, and it's allowed many governments to bring in policies that they would have liked to done, but the pandemic has given them the cover to do that. So, for instance, you know, dismantling humanities, protecting kind of corporate interests, even the rise of things like telehealth. You know, this is neoliberals have been calling for, you know, telehealth for years because it can help, you know, lower cost. And now the pandemic, you know, in the US, Australia, other places have brought in kind of telehealth legislation. And even Trump, you know, he literally said that the rise of telehealth has been one of the best things that's happened out of the pandemic. So there are these little kind of offshoots that, as we talk, the return of the state, all these kind of new interventionist policies, maybe this is the end of neoliberalism. There are little signs that's a kind of mutant neoliberalism, and to borrow the phrase of Will Callison, Zachary Manfredi, is also emerging out of the pandemic, something that I think we need to be really conscious of and to analyze as best we can.
So as we wrap up, I want to ask, or I'm going to start this by quoting from the blurb from Wendy Brown. Neil Vallely offers a rich tour of what he calls the futilitarian condition brought about by neoliberalization. Systemic and ubiquitous, this condition deprives us of meaningful lives and robs the world of a future. With an elegant pen, reader-friendly philosophical thoughtfulness, and scores of examples, Vallely explains that gnawing feeling isn't what I'm doing in my job, ecological practices, ethical consumerism, and more, really futile. Becoming common, he argues, is our only way out. So let's talk about becoming common.
Yeah. Well, thank you reading that blurb from Wendy Brown. I was just kind of blown away the fact that she even did that. And a really lovely reading of the book. So this process of becoming common, I argue, is central to how we might confront futilitarianism. So in doing so, I see futility, the concept of futility, acting in a similar way to something like precarity. And the way that precarity and the rise of the precariat has really helped found some very good kind of political movements around people who share this experience of precarity. My argument is that the idea of futility can encompass more people than the term precarity, because many people wouldn't actually see themselves as precarious. They might have a stable job or assets and so on and so forth, but they still might recognize this experience of futility in some way or form. So the process of becoming common is essentially a process of recognizing our shared but differentiated experience of futility, since some people experience much more crippling examples of futility than others. But at the same time, in recognizing that we share an experience of futility, this can lead to a process of what I call, becoming common to one another. And this becoming common has become so difficult for many of the reasons that I've talked about and we've talked about today under neoliberalism, because it's forcing us to see each other as competitors. So we need something that we can share. And I think futility and precarity and many other words can help in that process of becoming common. And so therefore I argue this idea of futility can become the basis of a new kind of collective political subject in the same way that precariat has. And I call this subject, the futilitariat. I'm sure, many other words, and whether that actually really is a term that brings people together is debatable. But basically, that we need to start a process of becoming common. As Wendy Brown said, it's our only way out. And perhaps futility can be a way, or can be a starting point of recognizing our shared experience of futility. This could be the starting point of building something that can actually confront that futility. And that's the kind of hope of the book. The aim of the book is to lay the theoretical foundations for the building of that common and collective political subject.
Well, let's hope. It's a wonderful text. I highly recommend it to people who are looking for a diagnosis of this present age. And the idea of becoming common, I think, is kind of the key if we're going to bounce back from all of this. Neil Vallely, thank you for your time today.
Oh, thanks so much, Tom. It's great to chat to you.
Once again, my guest today has been Neil Vallely, the author of Futilitarianism, Neoliberalism, and the Production of Uselessness by Goldsmith Press. My name is Tom DeSena, and you are listening to the New Books Network.